Folks, thanks for joining us this morning on The Extra. Probably one of the most special episodes we have had since we had Bill Roach on, who served in World War II as well. Today, we're so blessed to have Edwin Beck join us and share his story. You won't want to miss it. It's unbelievable. So, Ed, thanks for taking the time to come on with us today.
You're quite welcome.
So tell us a little bit about your journey, how it began, how you got enlisted and served in World War II.
Well, it was Pearl Harbor, of course. Mm-hmm. And we had a great big dinner. Both my grandparents was on both sides of there. And then a woman next door came over and she says, "They just bombed Pearl Harbor." And that ruined our Sunday because my uncle was there. He was in the Army already. And we didn't know if he's dead or alive. And we hit a couple of weeks before we find out. Anyway, everybody at that time wanted to get in there and serve their country. So I tried to get in there, and I was 17, and my mother didn't want to sign. She said, "No, no, no." And I said, "Well, I want to serve my country." So when I got 18, I enlisted into the Army.
Where were you living at the time?
I was just in high school. I was 17 years old.
And what city were you living in?
In Annville, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
That's where I was born.
Wow. So then you went down, and how did that process look? Was there an office downtown you went to?
I had to go down to, Allentown, and they had a place where they enlisted you. And then I got a physical and everything. I passed that. And then I went straight to camp. I went up to Harrisburg. And there, I was up there for about 3 days, and they shipped me down to Camp Wheeler, Georgia. And that's where I had the basic training. And I had 17 weeks basic training. And then I had an operation for a hernia operation, which I didn't get to go with the guys I served with there. And they sent me to camp to Missouri, to Fort Leonard Wood. And I joined the 97th Infantry Division there. And we started our training. There was a night training and all. And then we went out to California. And I thought I was going to go to the Pacific. And then they switched it around. And I ended up in Fort Arkansas. And then from there, they shipped me up to Camp Atterbury, Indiana. And there's a 106th Infantry Division, which I was put into there. And the first sergeant said, "You have to go see the captain." So I go and see the captain. He said, "Where did you have your basic training?" I said, "Camp Wheeler, Georgia." He said, "You're my new BAR man. As if you're running automatic rifle." Yeah. And I said, "Oh, okay." So I had two men that were helped me carry ammo. And we were there, and I remember the bill in the early morning, that first, the sergeant there, when they heard that, first noted that bill for Reveille, his feet hit the floor, and the lights went on, and he said, "Get the hell up." And we got dressed, and the one guy, we had those leggings that they laced up. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the guy put them on backwards. He had the right on the right and the left on the right now. And he got to the top of the steps and the three steps, and he was down on his face. Anyway, from there, then we went up to Camp Miles Standish. The ship was by train up there to Camp Miles Standish in Massachusetts. And we were up there for about a week. And everybody wanted to go out, and they more or less quarantined us. They didn't want us to go anywhere. But the captain says, I tell you, if you guys promise me you'll be back here by 11 o'clock tonight, you can go out to town.
Yeah.
So we did. And then we went down to New York, the harbor there, and we boarded the Aquitania, which was a French ship, which was the Aquitania, and the British was running it. And we got on that there, and the next day when we got out, the colonel came on the bitch bus, and he said, and this is his words, if there's any more of you all that send bitches on here, I want to know it now. Because one guy, when he started going up the pier, instead of getting on the ship, he jumped over the side, and he got killed anyhow, but he didn't want to go, overseas. And anyhow, that's what the colonel said. He's a regimental commander. And then we landed up in Scotland, and from there the ship was down to Liverpool in England, and there we got on these ships and sailed across to France.
Wow. So how long time since you enlisted until you got to this point?
It's about a year, yeah.
So about a year of training until
we had a year of training and everything. And then went into that division, and of course, then the strip mules had one other two different divisions. Mm-hmm. And then finally, on the 16th of December is when Hitler said, we're going to push you in the ocean, you know. And they had a counterattack. And on the 19th, or on the 18th, a major come around, he said, we got us in groups about six, so we didn't get hit by our children. And he says, the colonel got killed in the 88, hit his CP. And he says, I'm taking over, and we're going to move out of here. And evening, we moved out there on the 18th. And on the morning of the 19th, it's just the captain and about 20 of us. And we met up with some lieutenant from he was an anti-tank tanks. And he had about 10 men. And we finally got the captain, said, well, I'm taking over. He outranked the lieutenant, so says, he got in the Jeep, and we took the Jeep, and he started down the road. And we were out in the open there, and when the Jeep got down to the corner, the German sitting over the bazooka and blew up the captain and the lieutenant. So finally, we were out in the open, and we're jumping out of the vehicles. And they started shooting anyhow, and then we got the word surrender or else. And we couldn't see how many there were, but the Germans were all in the woods there. And so finally I asked the platoon sergeant, I said, give me your compass. He said, no, I know what you're going to do, because I'm going to take off.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't give me his compass. So finally, the Germans come along. We were surrounded. We were cut off for 3 days before that. But then there's only about 20 of us left, I guess. And they were finally surrendered. And then I knew a little bit of German, so I tried to talk to the German captain, what happens to us now? And he could speak better English than I could. No kidding.
Really?
He said, for you, the war's over. He said, we're going to push you in the ocean or fool it. So he said that German's going to push back into the ocean, you know. or their full lip. And of course, about that time the skies cleared and the Army Air Force come back and they started shooting them all up. And General Patton came up in his outfit. And then they pushed, and of course, we didn't push the New York, so we pushed them back into Berlin. So on the 19th, then, about noontime, that's when I got captured. And they marched us in, and it was just nighttime. We lay down in the snow. And then the Germans were around us. It reminded me of a couple of wagon days, you know. We were in the center of the Germans around us, fixed bayonets. And the next day, we marched, and we finally got to Camp Lindbergh. It was a Lindbergh, Stalag Lindbergh 12A. And we were spent one night there and had to sleep in the snow because the camp was full. And we we didn't know what we were going to do for us. Anyhow, we started walking, and we walked for 5 days. And we finally got in the boxcars, and they shipped us to Muhlberg, which was 12B. And we were there a couple of days, and then I got called with 15 other guys, and they took us out, and we went to a camp where we worked on a stone quarry breaking rock. And loading them up in these carts and pushing them down to the mill, and they're crying them up. They're fishing their roads, railroads. And it was on February, it was a fairly nice day. And I seen this woman going down, pushing her baby coach, had a baby in there. And all of a sudden you hear this roaring noise. And she stopped that baby coach, picked that little one up, and there's a tunnel at the end down there. And that's where she was heading. And even some of the guards are running down there. Here come the 1,000 B-17s. And Jeff roared, you never, beautiful to see them. 1,000 of them at a time. And anyway, I was saying, that's a give them hell, you know. And finally, I got so bad, I didn't have to walk one day because my feet were so bad I could hardly walk anymore. I had frostbite. And the guards come and got me and took me in, and this here guy interrogated me. So finally, he said, okay. And he used to interrogate me about four times, and the other guys couldn't understand why I had it, but I found out later. But anyway, got me outside, and he had a bicycle, and I had to wash his bicycle out in the snow, the water, ice in the water, and wash his bicycle, and I thought I'd done a good job. And the guard took it over and came back, and he says, I had to do it again. He said, I didn't wash each spoke separately. On the wheels. So I did that, and then I had to scrub his floor. He had a wooden floor and had to scrub with icy water and that. And the last day he interrogated me, I couldn't tell him nothing, because you just give your name and serial number. And he kept talking, finally he stood up behind his desk, and all I could see was that damn pistol hanging there. I didn't know if he was going to shoot me or what. And he told the guy, he said, get him the hell out of here. So he took me out, and then finally he said, give me a guard, picked me up, and took me to the hospital. And the doctor there, he was a Dutch. He was a doctor, but he was from Holland.
Okay.
He was a prisoner, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'll keep you here as long as I can. But if somebody comes in worse shape than you, he said, you're out of here. So finally I got back out of there and got with the group that had been in.
How long were you in there?
I was about going a little over 5 months.
Wow.
And then we ended up to a little camper, and they had about 30 Russian prisoners there. And there was us 45 of us, and about 5 English, and about 30 or 40 Russian troops. So the one day they took these Russian troops, and they were marching them out. And a P-51 come over, and they thought it was German troops, and they started strafing them. And they all scattered. And at night time, this one guy came back in. Some Russian kid, I called him a kid, just about to say, we're all about 20 years old, 19, 20. So he says, he had a pair of watercolors. I said, I want them. Tell him in German.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going home. He said, you're going to die. You escape, they will give you a second chance to kill you. I said, I know that. So I got two guys that said they'd go with me. And one was from Percy, Pennsylvania. His name is Julius Purcell. He's Italian American, speak Italian. And I got a kid named Yonkowicz from New Jersey. He could speak Polish. So we figured we have four languages. And old Purcell said, when are we going to go? I says, we'll leave at noontime one day. I said, well, the guards are all changing. So we went behind the building, cut a hole in the wire, and took off and went down the road. And we heard from the guards talking that this city has surrendered. And the mayor and everything in the city kicked all the German troops out. They said they were getting tired of being bombed.
Wow.
So anyway, that's where we were going. We didn't know how far it was. So we stopped a girl on a bicycle, and we asked her how far this was. And she said it was so many kilometers and stuff. I said, oh, man, we never got before dark. And we walked down the road and finally came up to a ridge and a hill there. And there was no pump bed, and there was no German soldier sitting there. He must have been about 60 years old. His rifle propped up, and he'd eaten. So we said, let's go ask him. I said, man, I don't know. He said, we've got to find out. So we over. Talked to this guard, this German soldier, and we told him about this girl on the bicycle. And he starts laughing. He said, these young girls think they went somewhere and they haven't gone nowhere. They got their legs gone. So we asked him where the city. He says, right over the hill.
Really?
And we went down in there, and they had nuns, had been prisoners. And they had shaven these nuns' hair, and they turned them loose, and they just walked around trying to place to go. And we finally saw this. I don't know if you ever been to Germany, but there was a big, big buildings with iron gates on them. So we saw this one there, and the old Purcell said, let's go there. I asked that guard, he's the guard that was on the gate. I said, oh, we just moved out of a place. He said, well, come on. So we go and talk to the guard. He opens the gate and lets us in. And it's a big hospital. And we go in. We get in there, and we see the Americans. And the guy sitting behind the desk, he jumped up. And he ran down the hall. I said, boy, we better get out. He came back. He said, the doctor will see you soon. We said, hey. And finally, we were a kid, it must have been about 12 years old, his head, legs were blown off. They wheeled him out, and we standing in a row, and Priscilla standing here, and the guard talked to him, and we talked about our feet were all bad, we didn't have a right proper. Anyway, then he talked to Priscilla, he talked to me, and I said, well, we'll be back. He said, what? So we went outside, and we had a big rolling line we thought was a child line. We got in this line as a beer line, but you had to have a container to put it in.
Yeah.
So there was a little kid there, and I had a couple of marks, and I give that tournament, give us a bottle of a 2-quart bottle. We fill that up, you know, for Tilly, because he's the biggest and oldest. He said, let me have it. He took us. He said, oh, man, I don't like that. It's dark beer, you know. And the, I said, I'll drink it. So we went back in there, and as we were standing there looking out this big picture window, American Jeep pulled in. One sergeant in it. No weapons. He had a special flag and everything. He's like an attaché. He could go in and out of the lines. And we got a hold of him. We were to get in that Jeep. He said, forget it. He said, I'm in deep trouble. But he says, I'll be back. And he came back. It was dark. And he says, I can't get you guys out of here tonight. But he said, tomorrow morning, an ambulance will come and get you out of here. And he was true to his word. But he was from the 104th Infantry Division. I remember that. And when I got, you know, when the Germans took us upstairs, and they took the German patients out. They put clean sheets on. That's the first bed we had to sleep on since we left England.
Oh my goodness!
And I died because the next thing I knew, the nurses pulling the shade up, and the sun was shining. And we got up, and the Germans came and took us down to Halle, Germany, where the airfield there, the birds had taken over, and we got on that thing, and I got to stand behind the pilot, and we flew into Camp Lickenstrike, France, and we were in there, and then they examined us again to see how good we were, and we started eating some better food, and of course I was down to 85 pounds then.
And what did you weigh when you got in?
About 140. Wow. And anyway, we were just happy to be there. And then the rest of the guys, they stayed there. And we told them that these other guys were in the prison camp back there, you know. And they said they didn't know there was a camp there. That's we got strafed a couple of times. And anyway, we then were just waiting for to get shipped home. So finally, General Eisenhower landed there. And I seen the Ivy's plane come in there. And I went through the chow line with him. And when he left, he had to still see him standing on that wing of that plane. And he says, men, we're going to get you home as fast as we can. He said, ships are on the way. And one guy hollered, give us a rowboat. None of that stuff. And he got back in his plane and took off. And finally, that was in June, and I finally got on this ship. And then I landed back in France, in the United States on the 19th of it was 19th of July, June, and I landed back in the States.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, Ed. We're going to get some commercials in. We're going to come right back and pick up on the story. Listen to Cardio News Radio. Stick around. Okay, folks, thanks for sticking with us. Very special time we have this morning with Edwin Beck, POW, served in World War II. And if you heard the segment before this, it's just breathtaking. It'll you make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. If you're just now joining us, go to Cardio News Radio and you can pick this up, listen to it, share it with your children, the next generation, and let them know what makes America such a special place to live. It is these heroes among us, and it's such a privilege for me to sit here with you, hear the stories, and it brings tears to my eyes of the courage, the sacrifice, and your willingness to go, you know, and serve our country. I just thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Because of Colonel Bieber is my reason why I talk and everything, because I didn't stay back in the service, you know, and I never talked about it. And he said, Ed, if we don't tell them, they'll never know how bad it was. So Colonel Bieber is the one that did that from his going on too. But from like I left it there, and I remember the first meal we had, it was nighttime, and it was a steak, I mean a great big steak, and mashed potatoes, but it was all American food instead of all the, because you're down to 85 pounds, you know, and I gained up to about 25 before I got back, and they gave me 74 days leave, so I got on the train, they gave me a bus ticket, I got on the train, then I got on the bus, and I got into my hometown, it was midnight, and there was no more transportation, and a guy came across the street, and I knew him, and he says, "Head back." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you're dead." I said, "No, I'm still alive." He said, "Well, I read in the papers that you're missing in action." I said, "Yes, that's true." But a couple of weeks later, they found out that POW, then they put it in the paper, and he never got to read that. So he thought I was really dead. I said, "No, I'm still alive." So I went to my grandparents' house and spent the night there. And the next day they took me back to my mother, my brother and sister.
And your mom received a telegram.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, she got the telegram that I was missing in action. And she hadn't opened it up and she didn't know what was inside. And she took it next door to the guy there. And he said, "Woman, you'll never know what's in there until you open it up." And it says, "Missing in action." So that's what he told me when I came back. Anyhow, so anyway, it was great to be home. Anyhow, so I had my 74 days. And I went back to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And then I got out to service for what? So I went back and finished high school. And then I went back into the service.
You went back and finished high school?
Yeah.
Went and served in World War II before you even finished high school?
Yeah. Yeah, I finished the last year because I got out there in the 11th grade. And I went back and I went through a summer. I started in June in summer school to get up to par, and then I graduated with my brother. He was 4 years later. Then him and I graduated the same class. Then.
Wow, that's incredible! And so, what was next? What was next for you? The next chapter of your life after graduating?
I graduated, and then finally I got. I went to Hershey and worked for a little while. About 2 years there. And then went to 1950 when they went to Korea. I was in the reserves there then. And me and the two other guys says, "You know what? Let's go over there and finish this here now." So we went, took our exams and everything, and got the transportation, went to the California, and from there they flew up to Alaska, and then back to Korea. We went to South Korea, and I was in the 116th of the first cab division then. And I was in the Baker Company. And then anyway, we got on a train there, went up, and we started going all through the war there. And we had, my captain, we had a pretty good captain anyhow. But we got up into North Korea. And finally, or one unit, we captured the North Korean capital. And that, because I forgot about the dates and everything, but one day, one of my brothers called me and said, "Do you remember where you were on the 19th of October, 1950? I said, "Well, that's true." He says, "We were, that's the day we captured North Korean capital." And we, "Oh, yeah, that's right." So, anyhow, and then I said, "Okay, so," and we took over the Japanese barracks, sir. And on Sunday morning, the chaplain had service, and I had some service, and went to bed that night. I have that army bed there. And next morning, got up, and we went out, and it was about, well, I don't know, it was about midnight when the lieutenant was screaming, "Get your men and let's go." I said, "Lieutenant, the war's over." I said, he said, "I don't care what the chaplain told you." He said, "Get your men and go. The tanks are out there waiting." So we had five or six men right on top of the tanks. And we pulled out of there, and we're going up around the road, and there was a turn, and I got to drive with the fellow asleep, and he went out over there with the guys on top of the tank. And we got up in there, and I was just shooting and shooting all the damn time. And then, like I said, we got out, and we just had the captain. There was a captain and about 20 men and the sergeant, one sergeant. And then we got up there, and then the Germans finally, well, the major told us, a day before, a few days before, he said, "We have cut off and surrounded for 3 days because the Germans had broken through and they were buying our horse." So,
Ed, you tell these stories and I hear about them. And what, when you're in a POW camp, what do you draw on to keep the faith, to keep fighting? What's going through your mind during those times?
I left sometimes because I think, but because we had one guy, I remember he was in Maine, and when the German troops told us to go out to in the prison at the stone quarry, why he said, "I'm not going out." So he stayed in bed, and we're all standing out there, and it's just semi starting to get light. And the Germans line slide by the continent, one man missing. And two of them went in, and here comes this, I can't remember his name, but he was from Maine, and up in Maine, and he came running out of there, getting his coat and stuff on. He said, "Hey, we think you're going out." He says, "Oh, shut up." And, "Hey, but why are you going out?" Here in the top bunk, we slept in straw like, and the German took the rifle's bayonet and stuck him in the butt. You know? He said, "You got stuck with a bayonet." Said, "You get on too." Said, "And but you had something to laugh about. You tried to get, and all you thought about is food, what you could eat, how your mother made your food, and everything." And you could, I said, "I can remember that big ham my mother used to cut open, put pineapple in the cooker." And I said, "Oh, boy, that's what it is." They always teach you, if you get a chance, learn everything you can and escape and take it back to your troop, you know. So that's where I was going to take off, and I answered the compass, you know, and that turned. Said, "Forget it." And then the course said, "Oh, well, It's gone now, but I used to dream about it when I was still in the camp. You wake up, you know, you didn't know where I was at, and I look around, and I see a window, and I say, oh, I'm home. But I just do the best I can. Like I said, the Colonel Beaver says, we got to tell them how it was, how they treated us and everything, you know. Some guys got treated pretty bad. And the reason they interrogated me all the time was my name. He says a German general named Ludwig Beck conspired to kill Hitler. And it failed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back to Germany, back in 61, well, this woman had the hotel and everything. I was in there, and she knew me. And she says, do you know how they killed General Beck? And I said, oh, that's why. And anyway, when the Gestapo went to pick him up, he said, I want to go in and say goodbye to my wife and kids, because he knew he was coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And he went in, he opened the desk drawer, took a pistol out, shot himself in the head. And he wasn't quite dead, and the guard came in and finished him off. So anyhow, that's why that guy kept calling me in and interrogating me, because my name was Beck. And so then I knew. But until then, I wondered why he kept interrogating me. I couldn't tell him nothing. I didn't know nothing. I was only a year in the Army. Well,
Ed, I appreciate you sharing these stories, and to be able to reach back in time and to remember this so clearly, it's remarkable, and it means a lot to have you on and be able to share this message with, you know, the next generation. And tell us a little bit of what you learned your time in the service, and what words you'd pass on to the next generation who's growing up now, like you were, a junior in high school, and the things you did for our country. Give a little bit of wisdom, if you could.
Well, I learned a lot of things. Be patient, anyhow. And of course, I went through a lot of schools in the military. Why they picked me a lot of times, it seemed the smallest guy had the biggest weapon. And I guess that's why your BA man didn't get to live very long. Because it's an automatic weapon. So anyway, I was a BA man there, and then I went through all them schools in the military, and I learned that I went through I had to go to flame flight. The captain called me one day, said, I'm going to take you down, you take a little, use a flamethrower. And always a small guy, because I guess we not as big, like a 650, get shot quicker. But I went through a lot of schools and everything, and I in the military, they said, I'm going to send you. I went to the schools up in school after school, and learned a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an instructor. I was an instructor at the base there then. And I was like a teacher, instructor, or even kind of. And I just learned a lot of stuff, sometimes someone comes back to you, even you forget names, and then a lot of times you see a ball player, you got a name, and I say, oh, I used to hire a guy like that. And I remember when in the career, I sent up, I had a big truck, and I had a driver, and we went to pick up supplies. And he got on the wrong road. I said, you're on the wrong road. No, Sergeant, you're on the wrong road. And I said, look up in that hill. He said, "They're Chinese." I said, "Yeah, Chinese truth. You took a little bird." And he said, "Well, we got back. He's late, so we got back, but we did get back. But you get on the surge, you see all kind of people, all kind of things, you know."
But, so you brought up patience, or there are some other, you know, values and things you would say to the younger generation today. What are some of the words of advice you'd give?
Be thankful that you're in this great country. The United States of America, the best around. And I'm glad I served. I wanted to stay a bit longer, but I had to, from the VA, I was ineligible anymore, and they kicked me out of the infantry, and they said I wasn't good enough for the infantry anymore, and they sent me orders, and I ended up in Camp Air. I told the guy, I said, "I'm not supposed to be here." He said, "Well, you're here now." So I had been reprofiled, you know. Mm-hmm. And so finally, I'd made it through anyhow, and I'd different classes I taught all through the military. I was first sergeant when I was in the down in the Fort Person, in the Fort, I can't see the name, in Arizona.
Okay.
Then they shipped me up to, you know, there's a fort up there, and I was first sergeant up in Alaska, and I had a lot of troops up there, and I learned to do a lot of things, learned to take care of other things. I had one kid come in, he says, "My mother just got killed. I want to go home." I said, "Oh boy!" So I got a type of paperwork up for him to get out of there. So I served a little bit everywhere. I had a pretty good time up in Alaska. That was after that. Fort Richards in Alaska.
Wow!
Then I had they said, "Hey, Ray, I got equipment up at Fort Greeley. Going to get you a crew, and you go up there," and we had to tear the stuff apart, destroy any important stuff there. That was at Fort Greeley, Alaska. Cool up there, man.
When you're in the cart and when you're walking without food, and you were telling me over the break how you guys were packed in like sardines.
Yeah.
One of the gentlemen's passed away. What's going through your mind when you're in a scenario like that?
Well, you just wonder what's going to come next. You don't know. Because you're a POW. You just disappear. You know about whatever will happen to you because they don't tell you. They couldn't just let you leave. Because on that one march, that's where guys said, I think I'm going to fall out. He said, they'll kill you. So it was arm in arm, and we went up over the hill, and it must have been fresh air or something in the house, but you never know when you're going to eat, if you get to eat. And we're in the work camp. I got a little bit of food than what you did in the regular prison camp. It was just like a soup all the time. Millet, I just tried to do my best. And like I said, the Colonel Bieber wouldn't talk to me. He said, "Hey, let's tell him all about it." And some of the guards, if they didn't like you, like old Strutt, he was POW in Korea, but the Japanese or the Chinese. And he said, if the guard didn't like you, and you didn't move fast enough, he said, take your rifle and let your head beat you up. And the old list said, he was big, 6 foot, looked like Abe Lincoln. And the guard made him stand out in the snow, barefoot, for an hour. And he said, now you go back in.
Jeez, Ed. We're all out of time today, but thank you again, you know, from the folks here at Cardio, the folks at Marigolds who do the Hometown Hero, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you for what you've done for our country, your service, your sacrifice. Thank you for coming in, telling the story, and it's just been a pleasure spending this time with you this morning.
Thank you. Wish I could have done more.
Well, I think you did quite a bit, Ed. We're really appreciative. And folks, thank Marigolds for doing this every week, stepping up and honoring Hometown Hero. You have Tom Martino joining you next.